From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the greatest basketball players in the history of the NBA, Bill Russell. During his 13 years with the Boston Celtics, he helped lead his team to 11 championships. He was chosen the NBA's most valuable player 5 times. Also today, session drummer Hal Blaine tells us how he came up with his famous hook on the Ronettes' classic Be My Baby. Over the years, he's played on thousands of recordings and played on at least 40 number one hits. He played on many Phil Spector sessions and recorded with the Beach Boys, the Mamas and the Papas, Simon and Garfunkel, and Frank Sinatra, to name a few. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A jury in Pittsburgh has found Richard Baumhammers guilty in a racially motivated killing spree that left 5 people dead. Mark Newtbar reports from member station WDUQ.
After only 2.5 hours of deliberations, the jury has found Richard Baumhammers guilty of 5 counts of first-degree murder and all other charges filed by the state, including ethnic intimidation. Baumhammers went on a shooting spree in April of 2000 that left 5 dead and 1 paralyzed. The spree began when Baumhammers killed his neighbor, who was Jewish, and then went on to vandalize 2 synagogues, kill 1 Indian national, 2 Asian Americans, and an African American. The jury will now have to deal with the trial's penalty phase. The prosecution is seeking the death penalty. During the trial, the defense contended Baumhammers was legally insane at the time of the shootings. For NPR News, I'm Mark Newtbar in Pittsburgh.
President Bush sent his first group of judicial nominations to the Senate today. The president asked for quick action on the nominations, which included 2 nominees that had previously been submitted by former President Clinton. President Bush sent a slate of 11 nominees. Most were conservatives, and 7 of the candidates are already serving as judges. The group includes 3 women, 2 blacks, and 1 Hispanic. Eager to have his first nominations confirmed without controversy, the president reportedly held back at least 4 nominations that could have faced resistance from Senate Democrats. They included Chris Cox, a Republican congressman from California. Republicans in the House have approved a budget for the 2002 fiscal year. The nearly $2 trillion spending plan passed on a mostly party-line vote. The spending plan calls for an 11-year tax cut of $1.35 trillion. It would limit spending growth for the next fiscal year to 4%. The budget includes more money for education, but not nearly the amount Democrats would like. NPR's Claudia Sanchez reports.
The budget approved by the House authorizes $22.6 billion for elementary and secondary education next year, a 22% increase over current funding. The Title I program, which targets low-income children, would grow to $17.2 billion over the next 5 years, nearly double what it is now, and there's $3.6 billion for teacher training. The problem, Democrats say, is that the budget negotiators have yet to sign off on any of these increases. Last week, the Senate voted for an additional $250 billion in school aid over the next 10 years. The House and Senate, meanwhile, have approved President Bush's testing proposal and a voucher-like plan that would allow children in failing schools to pay for private tutoring. But even these agreements may be in jeopardy as the fight over money intensifies. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 17 points to close at 10,866 in moderate trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 43 points, or nearly 2%, to close at 2156. This is NPR News. Hospital officials in Ghana say dozens of people have been killed in a stampede at a soccer match. 2 of the West African nation's leading soccer teams were playing at the stadium when fans of one side reportedly began throwing bottles and chairs onto the field. Witnesses said police fired tear gas into the stands, creating panic as spectators tried to get away. Florida Governor Jeb Bush traveled to Palm Beach and Volusia counties today. He was in the heart of the November election controversy to sign the state's new election reforms into law. Buzz Conover reports from Florida Public Radio.
Less than a week after the Florida legislature passed a bill changing Florida's election statutes, Governor Jeb Bush signed that bill into law. The new law does away with punch card ballots and forces all Florida precincts to have optical scan ballot systems in place before the 2002 election season. Governor Bush says the election reform law will make Florida the envy of the nation. While Governor Bush was signing the election reforms into law, former Vice President Al Gore was making his first visit to the Sunshine State since the presidential election. In a speech to travel industry executives, he welcomed the changes in Florida's election system. For NPR News, I'm Buzz Conover in Tallahassee.
The bodies of two Israeli teenagers were found today in a cave in the West Bank. Israeli police say the 14-year-old boys had been tied up and stoned to death. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon blamed the murders on Palestinians. The U.S. ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, said that one of the murdered boys held American citizenship. The murders came just 2 days after Israeli tank fire killed a 4-month-old Palestinian girl. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services in healthcare, education, and corporations. SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Russell, is one of the greatest players in the history of basketball. In his 13 years with the Boston Celtics, he helped lead his team to 11 championships. He was chosen the NBA's most valuable player 5 times. In 1967, Russell became the NBA's first African-American head coach when he replaced Celtics coach Red Auerbach. Russell served as player coach for 2 years, then retired as a player. In the mid-70s, he was the head coach and general manager of the Seattle Supersonics. In 1980, the Professional Basketball Writers Association of America declared Russell the greatest player in the history of the NBA. In 1999, Sports Illustrated named the Boston Celtics the greatest team of the 20th century and Bill Russell the greatest team player in history. Now he has a new book called Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership from the 20th Century's Greatest Winner. Russell revolutionized the defensive game in basketball. Among other things, he had to develop incredible peripheral vision.
We had a drill that we would put our hands out in front and move them away. Left hand would go left and right hand would go right, and see how far you could take them and still see them, both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, so that if I'm in the right position using my peripheral vision, about 90% of the time I can see all 10 players and the 2 or 3 referees.
Well, let me put this into play for a second. Say, I mean, you led the NBA in rebounding for several seasons. Say you're getting a ball on the rebound and you're using your peripheral vision to see where the rest of your team is so you can figure out who to tap the ball to. Tell me what's going through your mind, what you're doing physically and mentally on this rebound.
Well, first of all, to get the rebound, I try to get the position before the shot's taken. You see, if you watch a player, you have to count on players being good, first of all. And one of the things that make you good is consistency. So when I say, for example, I see Jerry West setting Casey up to take a jump shot from the right side. Well, I know most of the time if he misses, where the rebound's going to go because he's consistent. I have to count on his greatness. So I start going to where his misses go. Okay, now, when he misses and I get a rebound, I've collaborated with Kuzi or Casey, whoever my point guard is. When the shot's taken, they're to go to an open spot, either on the left side or the right side, which we've talked about before. And so using my peripheral vision as I make sure I got the rebound first, and then I look out the corner of my eye, and if we're at home, I look for a white uniform in that spot. Just the white.
Mm-hmm.
The color. Or if we're on the road, I look for the green. And so all I know is I see that green, just the color. I don't have time to focus in so that I see the whole person. And then I just, most of the time before I landed, I would have passed the ball to that uniform. And that would start our fast break. There's only one problem with that, though.
Yeah.
I don't get to shoot very much. Because by the time I get to the top of the key from the defense, Casey or Kuz, they've gotten one of the guys a shot. Because we used to get a shot. When I was having a good rebounding night defensively, we were shooting most time within 6 seconds. And they didn't wait for me. And every player likes to shoot.
Let's talk a little bit about your approach to blocking your greatest opponent, which was Will Chamberlain. He was 5 inches taller than you were. Now, you had the ability to jump. How did you use jumping and anything else that you could do to block Chamberlain?
Well, one of the things that I learned, maybe in high school or in college, that when people shoot jump shots, for example, or most of the shots now, very rarely do people shoot standing still without jumping. Now they shoot, sometimes they shoot a three-pointer without jumping, but most of the shots are jump shots. Well, when you jump to shoot, you cannot jump as high as you can. Because if you do, you won't be able to shoot at the end of the height. Because to see the shot starts in your feet and flows up through your body, and these are your fingertips. They may sound a little esoteric, but it's the truth. And so most guys that are good jumpers will jump as high as half as high as they can jump when they shoot offensively. Mm-hmm. The defensive player is not under those constraints. He can jump as high as he possibly can, because he doesn't have to shoot at the end of the jump. And so when Wilt would take his fadeaway jump shot, first of all, I was left-handed. And so I didn't have to reach across my body to get to his right hand. So I picked up 3 inches right there. Then I could jump as high as I possibly can. He's limited to how high he can jump. So I pick up another 3 inches. So now I'm up with the ball. Now, but with him, if I did that too often, that would not be an intelligent thing for me to do. Because with all his physical talents, he was also very, very smart. And so if you did something to stop him, what he wanted to do, he would make adjustments. And you did not want him to make an adjustment. So what I would do sometimes is, rather than try to block the shot, is when he's setting up for the shot, push him another 2 inches away from the basket. That changes the angle. It's very, very minute, but it changes the angle. And so he's shooting from a different angle, and that will throw off the shots half of the time. And so he's shooting, and he's making some, and he's missing some. But I want him to have the thought that it's just because he's just not shooting good. Not that I was harassing him. Because I didn't want him to ever think that I was harassing him. Because that would not be a good idea.
No, it sounds to me that you take a very analytical approach to the game.
Well, I wouldn't put it all like intelligence. You've got to remember now, this is not rocket science. This is a game that kids play.
In the days when you and Will Chamberlain were playing, and part of your job was to prevent him from scoring, could you have become friends with him off the court? I mean, would you ever hang out together, or was it best for you to not really get to know him as a friend and as a person, so that you could just be more kind of cold and calculating on the court and not?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I never tried to stop him from scoring. That would be a bad idea, because first of all, I'd be doomed to failure. To stop him from scoring, that wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. What my ambition was to make him less efficient. Say, if he gets 45 points.
Oh, right. Stop him from scoring as much. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
If he gets 45 points, if it took him 40 shots, then I've had a good night.
Right.
You understand me?
Yes.
Okay. As for friends, for 5 or 6 years, we had a Thanksgiving night game in Philadelphia at Convention Hall. You know where that is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the middle of the afternoon, Wilt would come to the hotel, pick me up, and we go to his house. And he came from a large family. six or seven kids, you know. And I would have Thanksgiving dinner with his mother and father, his sisters and brothers. And then his mother, bless her, would let me go and get in his bed and take a nap. And then we'd go to the game and just kick the hell out of each other.
And that was okay, huh? It didn't inhibit your ability to kick the hell out of him after, you know, his mother made you Thanksgiving dinner.
No, and it didn't bother him either. He didn't mind kicking the hell out of me. In fact, one of those nights he got 55 rebounds.
Right.
Against us. And so he was not inhibited in any way, shape, form, or fashion. Because, you know, when we got on the court, we were determined to outplay each other.
Right.
Now, the outplaying each other was for him to do what he did for his team as well as possible, and for me to do what I did for my team as well as possible, which were two different things. That's why I never, and he agreed, we never considered each other rivals. We considered each other competitors. Because in rivalry, one guy beats the other guy. In competitiveness, we were both enormously successful.
My guest is Basketball Hall of Famer Bill Russell. He has a new book called Russell Rules. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Basketball great Bill Russell is my guest. He has a new book called Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership. Now, you were Boston's first African-American star athlete, and I think when you joined the Celtics, I think you were the only African-American on the team for a short while. Is that right?
Just for 1 year. You know, what's funny is that with the Celtics,
yeah,
within the organization, that was never an issue.
What about outside the organization in Boston?
Well, at that time in the United States of America, that was very difficult.
What year are we talking? What year did you join?
I joined 56, 57 season.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was like seven years before the first, that 64 Civil Rights Act and before the Brown versus School Board. This is before all those things. And in this country at that time, it was very uncomfortable for African Americans and all walks of life. What made Boston unique was that in Roxbury, over 90% of the African Americans lived within 2 or 3 miles of each other. But that was also true to North End with the Italians. And it's also true in South End with the Irish Catholics. And then there was Brookline with the Brahmins. And there was a phrase they used to use that the Cabots only talked to the lodges and the lodges only talked to God.
Right.
and then you had the Jewish community. And so all these communities were separate. And they were equally mean to everybody. You know, and so it was like, it was more than just a race thing. It was also a cultural and religious thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, and I spoke about it. But I'll say this. The only reason I spoke about it in Boston was that's where I was living. You understand? I wasn't in San Francisco talking about Boston. I wasn't in Cleveland talking about Boston. I was in Boston talking about Boston.
Well,
you understand me?
Yeah. Now, what about the fans when you were playing? Did you feel that the fans in Boston were with you, or did you feel that, like, white fans were uncomfortable rooting for a black player?
To a certain degree, and that still exists. what happened is, for example, my second year in the league, I was the most valuable player. And in those days, the MVP was picked by the players. So my peers picked me as the most valuable player in the league. The all-league team was picked by the writers. I was second team all-league. So now, with my peers, I was the best player playing. But with the writers, I was the sixth or seventh best player playing. And so the fans, which quite understandably, they said, that's the way it is, you know. I'd always played to try to win every game because I had found in earlier in my life that these awards and things were extremely political. That's a polite way of saying it. And I would never let people that really don't know what's going on define to me or assign to me a place in history.
Right.
Not that I would accept. You understand me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that I have a sense of self that I know what I did, how I did it, and what I accomplished.
Basketball great Bill Russell is my guest. He has a new book called Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership. Here's a really important question. How do you feel about the longer, baggier shorts that players wear today compared to the shorter, tighter ones that players wore in your day?
Well, see, when we were young and energetic and the young ladies could see our thighs,
yeah,
we thought that was very attractive. But do you know how the long shorts came to be?
No, I don't.
Well, that's another thing we can thank my good friend, Michael Jordan. What happened was when he went to the Bulls, now this is a story that I've been told. When he went to the Bulls, he was, like all of us, he had some superstitions. So what he did was he wore his North Carolina blue and white shorts under his Bulls shorts. And so every time he'd fall or go do something like that, you could see that blue underneath. Well, from what I hear, the commissioner called and says, hey, listen, that's out of uniform. You cannot have that showing. So rather than stop wearing his shorts, he had his Bulls shorts made longer so they would cover up the blue. And so when Michael starts wearing longer shorts, and Michael was the man. And so everybody started wearing it. Hey, if Michael's wearing them, it's good enough for him. If that works for him, maybe I'll try it. Might help. And so all these guys are getting longer and longer shorts. But they have a limit, you know, on how close they can be to their knees and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's amusing as heck, you know. And then as a, you know, in this culture, we have a hair thing. You know, it's like when Bill Walton was really playing great at Portland, he wore a ponytail and a beard. And people up in arms about that. You know, athletes are not supposed to do that. That's for the hippies, you know. And then when I was a rookie, I hadn't started shaving, so I had a beard. And you have no idea how much conversation about the beard, which had nothing to do with anything. And now these guys are wearing these, they call cornrows. And the white guys can't do that. But when I was playing, a lot of the white guys grew crew cuts. I couldn't do that. And so, you know, it's like, it's just so funny to me when I see things that that people get upset about.
Right, and how things go in and out of fashion.
Yeah, you know.
Bill Russell, one last question. Can you still jump? Do you have any reason to jump?
I jump for joy sometimes because that's an integral part of my life. One of the first things I remember as a kid was running along and just jumping, just for the joy. I think jumping is really, really, really important part of our psyche. You can jump for many reasons, you know, and this is an expression. And so now I don't try to dunk anymore. I go for more pedestrian type of activities nowadays. So there's a place where if I have to get from one place to the other, I'd rather walk than run. So that when I get there, I can do whatever I want to do mm-hmm. instead of having to sit down and rest for 10 minutes.
Yeah, right. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry Gross, you have no idea what a thrill it is to converse with you.
Bill Russell. He has a new book called Russell Rules, 11 Lessons on Leadership. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Dell Trade Paperback Division, publisher of The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, featuring drummer Hal Blaine. It's just one of the thousands of recordings the Rock and Roll Hall of Famer has played on. Coming up, he'll tell us about some of his famous licks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When record producer Phil Spector needed a drummer, he often called my guest Hal Blaine. Those Spector hits are just part of the reason Blaine is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's also played on hits by Leslie Gore, the Beach Boys, Bobby V, Elvis Presley, Dean Martin, Roy Orbison, Johnny Rivers, Sonny and Cher, The Byrds, The Association, The Mamas and the Papas, Petula Clark, Paul Revere and the Raiders, The Supremes, Bobby Darin, Nancy Sinatra, and Frank Sinatra. Blaine is featured on thousands of records and over 40 number one hits. In 1963 alone, he played on Then He Kissed Me, The Do-Run Run, Another Saturday Night, Surf City, Surfer Girl, Surfin' USA, and this record, which has one of rock and roll's most famous opening drum lines. Hal Blaine, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Now, is the opening on Be My Baby, was that drum line your idea?
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer because Jack Nitzsche was a pretty prolific writer, but he wrote very, very thin in those days. You know, this was the beginnings of rock and roll. Somehow, with my experience, I keep thinking that I was an awfully good faker. And it could be that the lick went boom, 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 with a backbeat. Boom, 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 boom. And at one point while we were rolling, I may have missed the second beat. So we went boom, 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 and it stuck. It became a hook, and of course one of the most famous hooks in rock and roll. That also happened to me, just to get off the beaten track. It also happened to me with the Tijuana Brass when we did A Taste of Honey. The song, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and everybody comes in, da-da-da-da-da. Well, unfortunately, nobody was coming in together. It was like a train wreck. So at one point, me and my comedic mind, they went ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I looked at the band, and I started slugging with my bass drum. Boom, 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 diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle. Everybody came in, and once again, that became a major hook for that song. It happened to be my first record of the year.
Why don't we hear that part you're talking about? Blaine, what are some of the other records that had the most memorable beats that you played?
Well, I remember doing a record with Tommy Rowe. The record was called Dizzy. That was another one where I played a kind of a hook drum sound. Boom, dink, digga 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 ding, dink, digga 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 digga. Over and over, I found that by doing, I learned very quickly in the early days of rock and roll, that there were certain hooks that people wanted to go with, guitar players or bass players. And I found that I could do that with drums, and it worked beautifully. by repeating a particular, every four bars or every eight bars, repeating a particular lick. One of the great records that I did with Sam Cooke was Saturday Night, Another Saturday Night it was called. And that was another one with that same drum lick, every eight or 16 bars, whatever it was. Diggy dig 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 dig. And, you know, it all these drum licks kind of became the standard for rock and roll. All of the, you know, all the drummers that I've spoken with through the years have told me that they grew up listening to the records that I played on, and that's how they learned. And I grew up listening to Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, and that's how I learned.
In fact, I bet you've been to countless restaurants where people have been playing your rhythms on the table.
That has happened, I guess, in the past. You know, sometimes I've actually, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I've actually turned around to someone and said, do me a favor and let me play the drums. In a nice way.
Right.
Where I would explain to them that they were trying to play their fingers along with whatever the music was playing coming out of the speakers in the restaurant. That actually has happened to me, which is kind of funny that you would hit on that.
My guest is Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, drummer Hal Blaine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Hal Blaine, one of rock and roll's most celebrated session drummers. He's played on many Phil Spector sessions, as well as recordings by the Beach Boys, Leslie Gore, Roy Orbison, Johnny Rivers, the Byrds, the Mamas and the Papas, the Supremes, and Bobby Darin. Now, you did a lot of records with Phil Spector, including Be My Baby.
Yes.
What are some of the things he had you do that other session heads didn't? What was different about working with Phil Spector?
Well, first of all, every Phil Spector session was a party. Everyone on the session, all the guys and girls, were the first call people, the A, if you would, the A gang. Everyone wanted to work with Phil Spector because they knew that some kind of a hit record, I mean, it was the talk of the town. Phil Spector was the guy that everyone wanted to see how he worked. He had a big sign on the door that said closed session, and yet anyone who stuck their head in, he'd grab them and he'd shove them in the studio and he'd say, Hal, give him a tambourine or a shaker or some clavies, some noisemakers, let him play something.
The musicians who you used to play with on rock and roll sessions were known as the Wrecking Crew. Why were they called the Wrecking Crew?
In the late 50s, we started playing rock and roll, and a lot of people said it was a dirty word. They didn't want to hear that kind of music. They thought the musicians were just rank amateurs. They had no idea that we were all well-learned and studied musicians with degrees and so forth playing music. And the old-timers, the guys that we kind of replaced, used to say, these kids are going to wreck the business. And I just automatically started calling us the Wrecking Crew. And then I became a contractor very early on. And doing the hiring for the sessions that I was playing on. And I just started, you know, people would call me and they'd say, get your crew together. And I'd say, okay, the Wrecking Crew, here we go. And I'd make calls. Eventually I had a secretary who made all my calls and so forth. So the Wrecking Crew stuck.
What kind of, would you get, like, sheet music? What kind of, how clear was it to you what they wanted you to play, or how much improvising did you do?
The music that was handed us physically were usually chord sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Chord charts are just, they're just roadmaps, starting at, you know, at the top and going through to the end with certain stops in between. It's just like any other roadmap. The things with, generally, we were hired for our expertise is such, we could do anything we wanted to do, and if any of it was offensive in any way, we would be told, don't play this or don't play that, or, you know, I like this lick or I don't like that lick.
Did Spector hum for you or clap for you the kind of things that he wanted, the sound that he wanted?
Not on drum, not for drums. Phil used to use me like a racehorse. He would have me sitting there while he rehearsed. He would keep me from rehearsing, and I'd be chomping at the bit I want to play. And finally, he would point to me. He used to be in the booth, and he'd run back and forth. They had a huge window, and he'd run back and forth like he was conducting a symphony, and he'd look at the strings and use certain, you know, symphonic movements or the way a conductor would do. And he knew certain times he would look at me and he would say, now. And I knew he was saying now, which meant go for it. And I guess I used to go nuts sometimes on those drums, because if you listen to some of the fade endings on just about all those records, we used to go into double times and all kinds of things that were not unheard of on records. And everybody would go wacko. And then there was a time when Phil threatened to put out a record or an album of all the fades that we did. And the fades, if for those who don't know what a fade is, it just means when you hear a record playing and it gets to the end and it gets softer and softer and softer and softer and it's gone. That's called the fade. With Phil, it went on forever. And finally, when everyone had enough, and I always kind of had that feeling I knew when it was, I would go into my quarter note triplets against whatever was being played.
Clap a quarter note triplet for us.
Well, in other words, it's over, and I go da 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 da. So everyone knew, here it is, this is it. And Phil would never stop the machine until I played those quarter note triplets. So they're on the end of every record.
Now you were the drummer on a lot of the Beach Boys records.
Just about all.
But I think it was Dennis who was actually the drummer with the band. I imagine at the time nobody knew that he wasn't the drummer on the records.
A lot of people did not know in the early days that Dennis did not play on those things. Sometimes Dennis would come in and overdub a tambourine or something. But Dennis happened to be a friend of mine, and we each had our yachts very close to each other. We were both motorcyclists. But Brian used to come into the Spector sessions. He wanted to see what so many people wanted to see. They wanted to know what we used to refer to as sprinkling the fairy dust on this tape that made it a hit record, that Phil Spector seemed to everything he touched were hits. And obviously after about the second or third record that we did with Phil, you couldn't get in the studio, but everybody wanted to know who was this Phil Spector? What was he doing?
So you met Brian Wilson at Phil Spector sessions because Brian Wilson wanted to see what Spector
right.
was up to?
Right. Brian used to come in and see us. We were introduced at the time. I think at the time Brian might have mentioned the fact that, boy, I'd like to have you play for me sometime. And I said, sure, you know, I play for everybody. It was not a problem. I was also working with these other kids called Jan and Dean, major rock stars in those days. And, in fact, the Beach Boys used to come in and sing on Jan and Dean's record sometimes. Jan and Dean would go over and sing on the Beach Boys record sometimes. A lot of people didn't know that.
So did Dennis feel bad that instead of you on the records?
I tell you, I've told the story before. Dennis loved the fact that while I was in the studio in the afternoon making $35, $40 for the afternoon, Dennis, that night, was making $35,000 or $40,000 on stage. I mean, they were making a lot of money. And he was thrilled that he could just be on his boat. He didn't have to be in the studio. He didn't have to rehearse.
Well, let me rephrase the question. Did you feel resentful then that he was making all this money on stage and you were making next to nothing in the studio?
Not at all, because I knew what it was leading to, because my phone started ringing off the hook from Phil Spector dates and Beach Boys dates.
Right.
All of a sudden, I was getting calls for Elvis Presley and Johnny Rivers, and the Fifth Dimension came along, and Mamas and the Papas. I mean, everybody came out of the woodwork.
Is there a Beach Boys track that you particularly like your drumming on that we can play?
Well, you know, I'd have to think about that a little bit. There are certain songs that make you cry. Songs like God Only Knows, one of the beautiful songs. Good Vibrations, of course, was another sort of a trilogy of Brian put that song together. Sometimes we would do, you know, 5 minutes on a session, and he'd say thank you, and sometimes we would work for days putting that song together. He just used to use little bits and pieces of this, that, and the other. I remember that on one of the sessions, and I think it was part of the Good Vibrations, Brian wanted something different, a different sound with drums or percussion. We used to drink a lot of orange juice, and they came in little small bottles out of a vending machine. And I took three of those bottles, taped them together, cut the tops off to various sizes, almost like the tubes on a vibraphone. And there were three different sounds, and I used a mallet that would be used on a vibraphone, and I got this knocking sound. Three different knocking sounds. And I used it on that section where we were playing ba-da-dat, boo-doo-doo, ba-da-dat. Well, I was playing ba-da-da, ba-da-da, different tones.
Why don't we hear that part of Good Vibrations? This is Hal Blaine.
I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm backing up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm backing up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm backing up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Was Hal Blaine on drums and percussion? Now, Hal Blaine, we've been talking about your rock and roll sessions. You also worked with Sinatra. Did you have to get a different kind of beat when you were working with Sinatra? As a jazz singer, Sinatra was more behind the beat. Rock and roll tends to be very on the beat.
Well, one of our secrets to rock and roll was learning to lay back. And we used to, in other words, if you were looking at a scale on a ruler, every time your backbeat came on, one, two, three, four, every time we'd hit two and four, it would be just a hair behind that actual two and four. That was how I got the great feeling going all the time with Joe Osborne, the great bass player, and Larry Nechtel. You know, we were known as the three killers who used to come in and make these, like, Bridge Over Troubled Water records like that were just so incredible. All Grammy winners.
My guest is Rock and Roll Hall of Famer drummer Hal Blaine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Yeah.
My guest is Hal Blaine, one of rock and roll's most celebrated session drummers. When we left off, we were talking about recording with Frank Sinatra.
You mentioned Be My Baby. Boom, 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 bang, boom, 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 bang. When I did the record Strangers in the Night with Frank, which was record of the year, and his only gold single, believe it or not, that went right to number one, I was playing the same beat, quietly. Strangers in the Night, boom. Ba-ba-ba-ba, boom. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, boom.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night, what were the chances we'd be sharing love? Before the night was through, something in your eyes.
What was the rehearsal like with Sinatra, and what was the recording session like?
Well, generally, when you got a Sinatra call, it was a 6-hour call. Now, the standard is a 3-hour session. With Frank Sinatra, we would have a 6-hour double session call. 3 hours, an hour break, and then 3 hours of recording. Now, the reason for that was that in this case, Jimmy Bowen, who was producing, we would go in for the first 3 hours and rehearse whatever the song or songs were to make sure that we absolutely had it down pat. The engineers would go through all the lines to make sure that there were no glitches, no squeaks, no white noise, no red noise. They would go through all the chairs that the strings especially were sitting on, make sure that there were no squeaks, make sure that everyone had the lights on their music stands, no music stand rattles. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Because when Frank Sinatra walked in to record, he walked in, he walked around with 2-3 of us, 4 of us, said, "Hi, how you doing? Let's make a record." And bang, he was in the vocal booth and we were making a record. No fooling around, no mistakes, no nothing. Rarely did he ask to do a second take. Frank always knew what he was doing. He had rehearsed himself. He knew the songs. And It was unbelievable.
Say somebody else required a second take because they made a mistake, would he get annoyed?
You know, we never said anything, because by the time we were working with Frank, they could do a lot of things electronically. If a guy had a glitch, in the string section, they could somehow key him out, overdub him, and fix it up. Frank was the kind of guy that once he walked out of the vocal booth, he'd say, "Thank you all." He was gone with his entourage. That was it. I think it was only once that Frank Sinatra, I heard him say, "Jimmy, I really would like to do one more take, please, if you don't mind." And, of course, we would do one more take. And, instead of the full 3 hours, he would work for 15 minutes, and then it was over with.
You've been on about 8,000 different songs that have been recorded. Do you actually remember what you were on, or do you have to consult a list to figure out if you were on something?
Well, it depends. Obviously, I had all those records of the year, the Grammy winner of the year, and I don't have to think about those records. I know those records backwards. When it comes to certain songs, there are certain songs out there that I didn't even realize. I mean, when I was working with people like Dusty Springfield, I couldn't even tell you the song or songs. It was just a blur of so many songs and so many sessions. I don't know. It's very difficult to explain, Terry. I just played what I felt, and they let me play. You know, once you kind of make a name for yourself, then when producers would come in, they would say, "Oh, Hal, just do your thing. You know, don't worry about it. Just whatever you feel." They felt that I would always do the right thing.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Hal Blaine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You keep saying you got something for me, something you call love, but confess, you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah. You keep lying when you ought to be truthing, and you keep losing when you ought to not bet. You keep saying when you ought to be a-changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. You keep playing where you shouldn't be playing, and you keep thinking that you'll never get burned. Ha! I just found me a brand new box of matches, yeah. And what he knows you ain't had time to learn. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, boots? Start walking.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Crown Publishing Group Division, publishers of The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect by Bill Kovich and Tom Rosensteel. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about tax inequities, tax loopholes, and the president's controversial tax plan with New York Times reporter David K. Johnston. Last month, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on taxes. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.